Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie, a PhD student at Northwestern University. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with David Milne, a historian at the University of East Anglia. We'll be discussing his newish, but still extremely relevant book, World Making, The Art and Science of American Diplomacy. It was published all the way back in 2015 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is an interview that I wanted to do a long time ago, and so I'm thrilled that it's finally happening. In the book, Milne approaches the history of U.S. foreign policy as the history of ideas by examining the biographies of foreign policy thinkers from Alfred Thayer Mahan to Barack Obama. Milne helps us understand the changes and continuities in U.S. foreign policy by putting them in an ideational frame. One of the virtues of studying biography is that one's experiences shape how one sees the world, and that a life is idiosyncratic. Therefore, an examination of the lives of foreign policy thinkers can help explain foreign policy in all its own idiosyncrasies and contradictions. It turns out that it matters that Henry Kissinger was a U.S. soldier based in post-Holocaust Germany. It also matters, as we will hopefully find out during the interview, that Paul Wolfowitz won a cooking contest in Indonesia. If it hasn't already, the book should be read by historians of U.S. foreign policy, political scientists, and intellectual historians. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with David Milne about his no longer new, but still very relevant book, World Making, The Art and Science of American Diplomacy. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. And I'm really thrilled to be speaking with you today. I learned tons from your book, and I'm excited that we're chatting.
That's great.
So to begin, how did you become a historian?
Well, actually, I mean, I started off doing a law degree. So in the UK, you start doing a law degree age 18 when you leave when you leave school. You go straight from school and into studying law. And I was the first in my family to go to university, and I guess law seemed like a, you know, a sure bet, or a surer bet than other subjects, perhaps, and, you know, instilled confidence, I guess, you know, particularly my father, that this might be worth doing. But of course, I went to study law. This was at Glasgow University, age 18, and just didn't get along with it. You know, a lot of it in the first year, a lot of law is rote learning. I found it really kind of tedious, quite hard to engage with at that age. And so I dropped out of Glasgow and reapplied to a number of universities to study history, which was the subject that I enjoyed the most at school. So I spent 8 weeks studying law at Glasgow University, dropped out, reapplied, and ended up at the LSE the following summer, or the following September. And yeah, that's where I did my history degree. And I mean, while I was there at the LSE, there were a couple of courses in particular that I took in the final year. One was a course on Henry Kissinger and the crisis of U.S. foreign policy, and that was taught by UC Hannah Mackey, who wrote a great book called Flawed Architect on Kissinger. And I guess through the course of my degree, I got more and more interested in U.S. foreign policy, in particular the sort of the connections between ideas, intellectuals, individuals, and the shaping of that policy. So that was my sort of that was my early kind of academic experience of history. But really, moving away from law to history to do something that was, you know, more creative, subject that, you know, I would enjoy the reading, you know, potentially. And, you know, I found law quite a hard, you know, a hard beginning.
At the young age of 18, no kidding.
Indeed.
Yeah. And what brought you specifically to this book? Because, you know, this book is, it is U.S. intellectual history, you know, history of U.S. foreign policy, but it's not like other books on the subject. You cover a number of different foreign policy thinkers over a pretty broad period of time. So what was your original envisioning of the book?
So the idea for the book came to me as I was finishing, my PhD dissertation, actually, which was an intellectual biography of Walt Rostow. As I kind of researched and wrote the PhD, and as I came to revise the PhD for publication, I became more intrigued by the idea of, operating on a larger canvas. So the book on Rostow, you know, really focuses on his service to the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. But I like to think anyway that, you know, I use Rostow, to examine, you know, wider trends in U.S. foreign policy at that time, particularly in relation to the connections between the social sciences and social scientists, of which, you know, Rostow was just one, and the framing and making of policy. Biography, for whatever reason, has always appealed to me, and I found that, a style of writing, a style of research that I'm very comfortable with. But I think good biography, you know, can potentially, you know, communicate something that goes beyond, you know, the life of an individual to sort of capture sort of broader trends. And in respect to intellectual history, I thought, you know, why not write a book beginning in, you know, the end of the 19th century, more or less, and ending with the sort of the near present, using individuals and their stories and their disputes as, you know, a way to write a book that kind of has narrative drive, but also engages seriously with ideas. So that was essentially the sort of the process that, and I began, when I finished my PhD, my first job was a lectureship at Nottingham University, and I taught a course there called Intellectuals in U.S. Foreign Policy, and that essentially became the book. The ten individuals I taught in that course are the individuals I came to write on in world making. So, you know, in some ways, the Rostow book and world making constitute a single project. And the first book, which was titled America's Rasputin, is kind of like a chapter in world making. In certain ways, that's how it came to it.
And I want to talk about the scope of the book, specifically as it relates to the research and writing process. Like, what was it like writing about so many different people in one book? Were there problems? Did it come to you naturally?
You know, I think kind of populating the book was, you know, was really challenging, was really interesting. Essentially trying to identify, you know, individuals whose ideas were, ascendant potentially, or at least important, you know, to particular kind of eras in the history of American foreign relations. So you'll notice from the book that some chapters look at just a few years, as in the case of George Kennan, and some, you know, look at a far longer period, such as the chapter on Paul Wolfowitz, which begins, you know, 1977 and ends more or less in 2005. So, you know, each chapter you know, definitely kind of there were kind of challenges that occurred to me as I was thinking, you know, should I really write such a long chapter on Wolf Wolitz, given, you know, in many ways, you know, he was always at the second tier in terms of the advisory system in U.S. foreign policy. And, you know, that was challenging. And then, of course, you have the challenge of, you know, where the archival collections are. And, you know, as a British historian working in the UK, you know, getting to the US to conduct the archival research, to get the funding and so on is you know, obviously more difficult than for a US-based scholar. So, yeah, it was like a fair amount of labor, a lot of grant applications, you know, many of which, most of which were unsuccessful. And then finding the time to kind of, to do that necessary archival work. The book, the research for the book, it took me, you know, more or less 10 years from start to finish to research and to write it. And, you know, my two children were born along the way in 2007 and 2009, you know, which brings, you know, great pleasures, but challenges of their own. There was a lot to consider.
Was there something, like while you were doing the research for this book, did you come across anything, like a document or a particular archive that really changed your understanding of a particular person or a particular feature of U.S. foreign policy?
You know, in terms of, well, I guess to begin with, I mean, the exchange that really sparked my interest in writing a book, you know, such as World Making, it's actually in the Foreign Relations of the United States series, and it's an exchange between Walt Rostow and George Kennan in 1962 over this statement of basic national security policy that Rostow had drafted as chair of policy planning. Now, of course, that was a position that George Kennan had held, and the issues that Rostow kind of covered in this draft were ones that, you know, compelled a very kind of long and detailed and at times quite robust and sharp and critical response from Kennan. So Rostow's, you know, interest in expanding the U.S. foreign aid budget and devoting more attention to policy areas that, you know, Kennan viewed as, you know, peripheral, as largely unimportant or tangential to U.S. interests. You know, this exchange between these two different, very different worldviews, you know, was really kind of revealing and interesting. At one point, Kennan writes, you know, you have this very rosy, optimistic view of the sources of human behavior, which I do not share, which, you know, is kind of like a fairly kind of neat encapsulation of a certain type of optimism that did animate Rostow and his ideas. And I like the idea of using these exchanges and using these points of disagreement and criticism to kind of provide the book with a certain narrative drive. But going beyond that and probably staying on George Kennan, so I had a fellowship at the American Philosophical Society in 2009, which was fantastic in all kinds of ways. But what I did when I was in Philadelphia was I was able, through the fellowship, which was very, you know, quite relaxed about using collections, not just in Philly, but in other places too, I would take the train up to Princeton. And I took the train up to Princeton to look at Kennan's papers. And when I arrived there, the archivist, Daniel Link, said, you know, we've just opened Kennan's diaries. You know, his diaries have just been, you know, opened for release for the use of interested archival researchers. Would you like to look? And I said, yes, I would indeed. That would be fantastic. So I spent so much time kind of poring over his diaries. Of course, a few years later, these were, you know, edited and published, edited by Frank Castigliola and published by Norton. Really kind of, he did a fantastic job. But I was there kind of reading, you know, the handwritten diaries of George Kennan, and the material, you know, contained within that diary series was, you know, I use it all through the book, not just in the chapter on Kennan. but in the chapters on, you know, Paul Nitzer, on Henry Kissinger, on Paul Wolfowitz, to have a resource that was so illuminating, but one that covered such an expanse of time. You know, so Kennan was still writing diary entries, you know, in 2002, you know, age 99, you know, it's truly, it was just a gift. And that was a source that I was, you know, so delighted to kind of be able to take advantage of throughout the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, each chapter in your book is about a particular foreign policy thinker. But I think some of the most interesting aspects of your book are like the debates between the chapters. Mm. And so, you know, Kennan, you know, he pops up over and over again. That's really neat that this came from a document that an archivist introduced to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was a gift. And, you know, as you know, yeah, he pops up in chapters, you know, like this kind of ghost reappearing at the feast, you know, generally, yeah. You know, issuing these terribly gloomy kind of utterances, which actually in the main tended to be absolutely right, whether it's on the, you know, the Americanization of the Vietnam War, whether it's in reference to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. So yeah, that was immensely useful to have.
So before we get specifically into some of these other foreign policy thinkers, I want to briefly talk about thinking about U.S. foreign policy as intellectual history. So you have a line where you write, U.S. foreign policy is often best understood as intellectual history. And elsewhere, you argue that, you know, we should be placing U.S. foreign policy into an ideational frame. And so this cuts against, you know, a variety of other approaches to U.S. foreign policy, you know, ideology or economic. What is your case for seeing U.S. foreign policy as intellectual history?
So in reference to, well, perhaps I should talk a little bit about in terms of the influence or the intellectual influence that, pushed me or prodded me in this particular direction. It was taking a course. This was a master's course that I took at the LSE with Professor Arne Westad on the Cold War and Third World Revolutions was the title of the course. And it was a course that became the Global Cold War, which, of course, I mean, it's a wonderful book, won the Bancroft Prize, and is, you know, superb in so many different ways. And at the beginning of that book, I mean, Westad, you know, was a student of Michael Hunt's at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and is very attentive to the importance of ideas in regards to, well, many different, you know, parts of the world, but in reference to U.S. foreign policy, and, you know, in particular, in reference to this book that he wrote. So the first couple of chapters in that book that look at these two competing universalisms, if you like, the U.S.-led liberal capitalism and Marxism-Leninism, I think really kind of alerted me to, you know, some of the possibilities of using ideas to illuminate, you know, essential elements of what it was for U.S. power to be interacting with the world. So Westad research was important. I mean, also, and this came out again when I was researching my PhD, from a British perspective, the U.S. is kind of distinctive in a sense, you know, and it's distinctive in a sense that there exists in the U.S. foreign policy machinery, as you know, almost a revolving door that exists between academia and the policy world. And so many intellectuals, so many university academics have, you know, very purposefully in some cases, you know, set out to write, to research, to publish in such a way as to attract the attention of a president or a presidential aspirant, and have, you know, in the fullness of time, acquired policy influence. U.S. foreign policy, in other words, you know, it's an area where it's very receptive to ideas, to intellectual output, for good and for ill. And there's plenty you know, instances of ill, I think, you know, not just in, you know, in reference to my book and the one on Rostow, but there's so much, you know, so much wonderful research in this area by, you know, individuals such as Daniel Besner recently, but it's a very long list indeed. And again, you know, another book, I mean, probably my favorite book still on the Vietnam War, is David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest, which is interesting. I attended a panel at the OEH a few years ago on the cultural turn in US foreign relations, and The Best and the Brightest was described almost as a work of cultural history, which I kind of get that, you know, designation, or why you know, it could be sort of portrayed in that way. But it's also a book that's very, very attentive to ideas and the knowledge power nexus. And again, that was another book that, you know, alerted me to, you know, perhaps there's a way to approach this that, you know, that focuses on ideas, not simply as a device, you know, to tell a story, but because they're, you know, immovable, they're you know, pivotal, they're centrally important to what the United States does and has done in the world.
Finally, I want to get into some of these foreign policy thinkers. But before I do that, I just want to kind of lay out which thinkers you look at. And so, you know, you start off with Mahan. He's sort of the open door imperialist. You have Wilson as the liberal internationalist. You have Charles Beard as the, you know, isolationist, if that's a term that we want to use. We have Walter Lippmann as the mouthpiece of FDR. And then we have George Kennan and Paul Nitze as two different kinds of Cold War intellectuals. Then you have Kissinger as well. And then you have Wolfowitz kind of representing the neoconservative turn in U.S. foreign policy. And then finally, Obama as the pragmatic liberal. I just wanted to lay them all out for our listeners. But to begin, I want to start off talking about Alfred Mahan. I really enjoyed the chapter. I knew very little about his background coming into the chapter, and I learned tons from it. And you write that Mahan anticipated the shape of the modern world, which is quite bold. And so I want to know, who is Mahan and what was the world that he anticipated?
Yeah, so Mahan, in you know, a particularly kind of influential book published in 1890 on the influence of sea power upon history, Mahan, well, I guess I should sort of begin by saying, in its first draft, this book was a very dry, unappealing, really, history of Anglo-French naval rivalry through the 17th, 18th centuries. And he submitted it to many, many publishers, and he kept saying no, until one publisher said, okay, maybe this is publishable, but what it needs is a introduction that sets out, you know, why this story of Anglo-French naval rivalry is relevant to the United States at this particular moment, you know, the late 19th century. And so Mahan set about this task, responding to what the editor had asked him to do. Now, the introduction, or the introductory to the book, and this short section on elements of sea power, kind of far surpasses anything that kind of happens next in the book in terms of its enduring significance, if you like, its insight. This is what we read, really, when we read The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. And what he does in the book is, well, in some respects, he calls for the United States to much more consciously emulate the United Kingdom in devoting more resource to its navy. Not as a means to conquer or acquire colonies in the way that you know, Great Britain had done potentially, but really as a means to sort of facilitate free and open trade. So Mahan's idea was that coaling stations, when acquired strategically and important points across the world, this is going to put the United States in an incredibly sort of advantageous position in regards to the development off its economy. Now, the economy, or the US economy at this time, is not at all export dependent. Of course, this is a huge sort of domestic market. Some of what Charles Beard comes to argue in the 1930s, and I discuss later in the book, in regards to American self-sufficiency and the notion of continentalism, that the US can pursue a policy of autarky. You know, this is, in some respects, you know, feasible, certainly in the time that Mahan is writing, and then, you know, further down the line as well. But in terms of, you know, what I mean by anticipating the shape of the modern world, I think it refers really, or what I'm referring to there is economic forces that are powerful, that relate to, well, I suppose, to use a more contemporary term, sort of globalization, and to advocate or to urge the United States to adopt a policy that is going to serve US interests, certainly at the time in which Mahan wrote, but even more powerfully so in the years to come, you know, potentially sort of way down the line. You know, Mahan and his outlook and his sensibility, you know, he was a devotee of Alexander Hamilton and the ambitions that he had for the Republic. He had no time really for the sort of the Jeffersonian notion of this sort of idyllic, you know, nation of small holding, you know, farmers. He, you know, was focused intently, ruthlessly on the creation of a very different type of American empire. And, you know, when I say a different type of American empire, I mean, following the Spanish-American War, Mahan was skeptical, both about the notion of going to war with Spain, but also about the wisdom of acquiring, well, certainly the Philippines, he was deeply ambivalent about. And, you know, he didn't want the United States to become a colonizing power in the sense that Great Britain and France had been one, but to be something different. And, of course, this is a story that Daniel Immerwahr, and in some respects, tells in his in his recent book on How to Hide an Empire. So yeah, so this is why I view Mahan as significant in this way.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And so just moving on to Wilson, there's a lot that we can say about Wilson, but something that I'd like to reflect on is just how much other foreign policy thinkers returned to Wilson, you know, either to beat him up or to emulate him. And so Wilson's like another figure that, you know, appears and reappears throughout your book.
Yeah.
Why is there this tradition of like going back to Wilson just so often in US foreign policy thinking?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this body of ideas that Wilson, you know, pronounces on and unveils in various speeches, and of course in the 14 points as well, the set of ideas that becomes known as Wilsonianism, you know, a very kind of distinct ideology and also, you know, a marker or a way to self-identify as a supporter of a particular way of conducting, you know, US foreign policy. Absolutely. I mean, Wilsonian is, of course, used today, and it was used in the Obama administration. I think many of Obama's advisors would have been quite happy to identify us, you know, as Wilsonian in many respects. Annalise Slaughter, Samantha Power, I think, to a degree. It's kind of fascinating that these ideas have endured, so, you know, in this way. I mean, it's interesting that George Kennan, in some ways, contributes to Wilson's kind of centrality to the 20th century U.S. foreign policy and to the tradition, in that he wrote this book, American Diplomacy, 1900 to 1950, which became hugely popular and, of course, is a really important expression of Kennan's, you know, variant on classical realism. But, of course, for him, Wilson was, you know, if not quite a villain, he was certainly someone who ushered in a wrong turn, so far as U.S. foreign policy was concerned, in regards to this legalistic, moralistic set of ideas or mindset that Wilson subscribed to. And I think, you know, one of the, I mean, there's a, a wonderful historian, Southern Methodist, Thomas Nock, who's written on Kennan and Wilson, you know, Kennan's intellectual relationship with Wilsonian ideas. I think when you, as you kind of follow Kennan through his career, one of the real surprises for me came in testimony that Kennan delivered in the Senate in 1989. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan, during the Senate testimony, asked Kennan a question, and it was, you know, given that the Soviet Union seems to be moving in a very different direction, given the Cold War as we know it appears to be winding down, is the time not right for Wilsonian ideas to reemerge as a, you know, as a force, as a shaper of U.S. foreign policy? And but rather than saying no, this is a terrible idea, you know, Wilson's had this negative effect, Kennan said, well, actually, there are two areas where Wilsonian ideas are vitally important, and that's in reference to climate change. It's impossible, you know, to have any type of global response to this, looming crisis of climate, unless every nation is invested in that response. So here, you know, Kennan's really alluding to Wilson's belief in international organizations and, of course, the League of Nations. And then secondly, in regards to nuclear proliferation, you know, he believed, you know, fervently that a serious, very serious response to the proliferation of nuclear weapons was necessary, and the way to achieve that again was through a Wilsonian sensibility, a set of ideas that again has an international organization at its heart. So Wilson, he was so important to virtually every, you know, Cold War president, even the ones that don't necessarily speak a language that necessarily resonates with Wilson, such as Richard Nixon, they end up in many of their speeches espousing ideas, using language that is, you know, Wilsonian in lineage, whether it's in reference to, you know, to freedom, to liberty, democracy, and so on and so forth. And just a sort of a final point on Wilson, it was fascinating watching the Republican primary debates. I guess this was 2015. You know, you had Ted Cruz at one point during a Republican primary debate say, you know, I'm not a Wilsonian democracy promoter, I think was the, you know, to paraphrase, you know, he's not, you know, he wanted to assert the fact that he was not a Wilsonian. He did not believe in deploying U.S. force to serve altruistic goals that weren't pertinent and that didn't directly advance the U.S. national interests. So even in a Republican primary debate at that time, Wilson is there, present as a point of reference. And of course, the likes of Jeb Bush, I think Marco Rubio, you know, they would take a different view. And would view the Wilsonian legacy in foreign policy terms, at least, particularly as it pertains to democracy, if not, you know, to the centrality of international organizations, you know, they would view Wilson in much more positive terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so perhaps if maybe Kennan isn't the ghost in your book, perhaps Wilson is the actual ghost.
Yeah,
Kennan is just like the brooding intellectual on the sidelines.
That's right. Well, yeah, that's right. Because Wilson is a ghost in the sense that he's dead, and you know his ideas are there. Kennan actually is there, you know, physically, and you know it's remarkable actually that Kennan remains you know so active intellectually and so lucid throughout.
Yeah. So just moving on a little bit, I was struck by how the 1940s played out in your book. You know, the 1940s are like a really critical decade for U.S. foreign policy history, just in general. But it seems like the majority of your actors are doing something in the 40s.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's like Charles Beard criticizing FDR or Lippmann sort of doing the same, but then not. And then Kissinger is he's fighting as a U.S. soldier, and then he's a student. Kennan working as a diplomat. And then you have Nitze as like a national security manager. And so they're all sort of appearing in this decade in different guises. Can you say something about this decade and why it matters so much in your analysis? And perhaps like what all of these different actors, maybe not all, but what some of these actors are thinking about?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right in regards to the individuals in the book. You know, if you draw these circles, you know, as a Venn diagram, yeah, the shaded area in the middle is you know, the 1940s. And it was interesting when I was considering, or rather it was interesting for me to try and figure out who I'd like to use or who I'd like to write about specifically in the context of this decade, and particularly the Second World War, you know, the period actually immediately preceding the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor up to the end of the war. And it was difficult in some ways because FDR certainly was, someone keenly interested in foreign policy, you know, a great admirer of Alfred Thayer Mahan, someone who served in the Wilson administration, but not, you know, not an intellectual, certainly, I think, and also someone who, you know, hadn't written a great deal on foreign policy. Most of the people that I look at have a published kind of corpus before they come to formulate their ideas about the US and the world. So Walter Lippmann struck me as an interesting individual to look at in this context, because he was there, throughout. He obviously had his hugely influential column Today and Tomorrow. But, you know, he had the ear of the president as well to a significant degree, although, of course, he had written some pretty unkind things about FDR in 1932-33, and, of course, about the New Deal later. Lippmann, in regards to his impact, which is of course difficult to trace on public opinion, but given the readership that Lippmann had, I think given the quality of some of the insights that he produced, particularly in his book U.S. Foreign Policy, Shield of the Republic, published in 1943, and in other ways too, he was a useful individual to look at in kind of explaining how the United States turns from this, you know, profound reaction and response against Wilson and Wilsonianism through the 20s and into the early 30s. And then FDR's, you know, to begin with, very incremental, faltering, but then, you know, into much more sort of decisive steps to take the United States into much sort of deeper engagement, particularly in the alliance. And support for Great Britain, which happened much later. And of course, you also have Charles Beard, you know, writing on this period, presenting a view, I suppose this is kind of the last hurrah in certain respects for a foreign policy approach or approach to the world that really does owe a very kind of conscious debt to Thomas Jefferson and his hope that a genuine isolation is possible in regards to the economy, you know, principally. Beard is deeply fearful about the world that emerges following the Industrial Revolution. Beard's very first book, which he wrote when he was at Oxford, this is before he wrote his PhD, was a study of the Industrial Revolution and the, you know, the misery that this causes to workers, those who kind of toil to make this happen, the descent of many British cities, the slums, the smoke. You know, he views industrialization, I think, writ large in very, very sort of negative terms, in the way that Jefferson, I think, would in certain respects. And, you know, Beard makes this attempt, you know, to persuade Franklin Roosevelt that actually, you know, tending America's own garden is a feasible proposition. And Roosevelt, you know, decisively, you know, rejects that, takes the United States in a very different direction. Now, what the Second World War, you know, does from Beard's perspective is, you know, the impact is almost wholly negative. The war leads too much resource, clearly, or it leads resource being allocated in much too high a proportion to defense. He believes that education in the United States is suffering as a result of this. And also, in a very kind of profoundly conservative way, he dislikes or he has problems with the entry of so many women into the workforce in the United States through the war years. He fears this is going to be very damaging to the American family. It has significant implications for labor. You know, the Second World War, you know, for Beard is, you know, something to mourn, not something to celebrate, in spite of, you know, the very real stakes involved and, you know, the fact that the principal adversary in the European theater is Nazi Germany. And still, Beard finds it profoundly sort of problematic. For what the Second World War does for other individuals that I write about in the book, for Henry Kissinger, for example, is an utterly transformative effect, you know, has a transformative impact. It kind of makes Henry Kissinger to a certain degree. You know, the U.S. Army, the service that he performs in post-war Germany, the advantage that he takes of, the way in which Kissinger returns and takes advantage of the GI Bill to study at Harvard. You know, this, you know, is seminal in regards to the development of Kissinger's career. Paul Nitze, of course, isn't in the European theater, you know, principally, but he travels to Japan following the firebombing of Tokyo and the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You know, he draws really, you know, fascinating and in some ways counterintuitive conclusions from the experience of witnessing the devastation wrought by the atomic bombs. And it's, you know, essentially, actually, he sees Tokyo and he sees Nagasaki, and he doesn't really see any huge difference between the devastation caused by firebombing in Tokyo and the atomic bombing in Nagasaki. Both cities are absolutely flattened. And he views, you know, from that point on, atomic weaponry as a usable weapon and something that has a real kind of practical applicability. And this is why, in part, he urges so strongly the development of the hydrogen bomb, you know, when that debate is kind of first ushered in 1949. So the 40s, you know, it's the end of American innocence. It's a devastating intervention for Charles Beard because of what it does to the, you know, U.S. society. The upending of, you know, the family life, the devastation it's going to wreak potentially on education. But for most, the Second World War is the, well, to coin a cliche, it's the incontrovertibly good war. It's the instance where the U.S. deploys force to advance a just, a righteous cause. And the intervention is, and of course the famous Munich analogy, is one that so many of these individuals invoke at various points throughout their mm-hmm. their career.
So we haven't actually talked about the title of your book yet, but I think now might be a good opportunity to do so because you start off the book thinking about a debate between Nitze and Kennan over the question of the hydrogen bomb. What does this say about the two approaches, the, you know, the seeing foreign policy as an art and seeing foreign policy as a science? What does this debate say about that?
So, I mean, just to kind of convey just a brief sense of what I'm attempting to do with the art science sort of binary. I mean, one of the interesting things to me, particularly, I guess, as an outsider looking at U.S. foreign policy through the 20th century and beyond, and certainly in the period post 1945, is you have the rise to policy relevance of the social sciences, which you don't have clearly in previous centuries in Britain and 19th century. The professional social sciences don't exist in the way that they do in the United States in the 20th. And, you know, tracing the impact that this has on foreign policy, on the type of advice dispensed, on the grandiosity or otherwise of certain plans, proposals for how the world or how the United States should interact with the world, that seemed to me very important. And it's something that Reinhold Niebuhr writes about in his book, The Irony of American History. You know, he views the rise of the social sciences with, you know, some concern and skepticism that the world isn't, it lacks a pattern. It's important to treat the world as one might treat a laboratory experiment. Nothing's possessed of stable properties. And so I think Niebuhr's writing on that, Kennan's to a degree, Hans Morgenthau's book, Scientific Man versus Power Politics, which again is kind of alert to some of the potential problems that might come from, viewing the world as makeable with the application of the right theories. This had an impact on the way that I set things up and the way that I framed it. Now, in regards to the hydrogen bomb debate, I mean, it was interesting to me initially looking at it that when Kennan approached this problem should the United States develop a hydrogen bomb, he turned to philosophy, he turned to literature, he quotes from the Bible in his very long 79-page paper, urging the United States not to develop the hydrogen bomb, that this is abhorrent, you know, morally and in so many different ways. This simply should not happen. And that was very, very much keeping with Kennan's kind of intellectual outlook, his likes, his dislikes, his sensibilities. Kennan believed that a good foreign policy education, and he actually wrote a memo on this at one point, I think it's 45 or 46, you know, how should a good foreign policy advisor be trained? How should a diplomat be trained? Kennan believed it was in history and philosophy and literature. These were the key texts or genres or types of reading that one should engage in. Now, Paul Nitze was very different. He set up what would become the School for Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. in 1943. And he and Christian Herter, with whom he collaborated, believed that foreign policy the teaching of foreign policy had to change, that it wasn't enough to use history, philosophy. It wasn't enough to respond on a case-by-case basis, reactively to events, you know, emerging in the world. That, you know, the social sciences, the field of international relations, as it would develop, this was where, you know, wisdom potentially could be derived. And of course, in the case of Paul Nitze, he was influenced by psychology and psychologists such as Nathan Leitz or Leites, I'm not even sure how you pronounce his second name actually, at the RAND Corporation, and he believed in the application of systems analysis, you know, to foreign policy problems. So when he considered how the hydrogen bomb or whether the H-bomb should be developed, he figured out the science. He interviewed Edward Teller. He looked at this as a problem that could be, as a question that was best answered with recourse to a type of thinking that didn't necessarily take into account issues of philosophical import, that didn't necessarily engage with great works of literature or were inspired by that, but looked dispassionately, coldly, perhaps scientifically, at, you know, what would the United States, if the United States declined to develop the H-bomb, would the Soviet Union follow suit? He concluded it would not. It would be dangerous for the correlation of forces, as he described it, to tilt so much in the direction of the Soviet Union. He doubted that an international organization was fit for the task of keeping a lid on this technology. And so his calculation was that the US must proceed. So in part, it was the kind of the sources, you know, the you know, where each individual looked, which books they turned to for, or types of thinking they turned to for inspiration, for instruction, and I guess in Kennan's case for solace. That was you know, that was kind of fascinating to me.
So we're gonna skip over a bunch of your book as we're nearing the end of our time, and also your book is a very large one. So
it is. Yeah. That's right. As my editor reminded me many times after various drafts that I sent up that sent back that hadn't cut quite enough.
As a historian reading it, I loved it. I wanted to talk about Paul Wolfowitz. This was another chapter that I really, really enjoyed. And again, I didn't know very much about Paul Wolfowitz, you know, but he serves as sort of your neocon, representative. And his career just really, it just follows the overall trajectory of neoconservatism so closely. But yet he's also really unusual or at least like unique compared to other neocons. He's extremely cosmopolitan. Mm. He had a sincere interest in like foreign cultures and foreign languages. Christopher Hitchens called him a bleeding heart liberal, aside from the national security stuff.
Yeah.
So just in really broad strokes, can you paint that picture of Wolfowitz for our listeners?
Mm. So, I mean, what there were many things that struck me as interesting about Wolfowitz. And I just want to give a shout out to a chapter in a book by Richard Immerman, Empire of Liberty, which has a chapter on Wolfowitz and was, you know, really kind of important in terms of setting me on a particular path and how to think of Wolfowitz. And, you know, Immerman's chapter is kind of fascinating. He doesn't hide his, you know, disapproval of the advice he dispensed in regards to, well, many, many different areas. But this was where I discovered, and while he was living in Indonesia, he was U.S. ambassador there, you know, he fully immersed himself in that culture. And
he won a cooking contest.
He won a cooking contest. This was a detail that I got from Richard's book that I just found absolutely kind of, you know, fascinating in so many different ways. And, you know, that description, you know, that Hitchens kind of puts, I mean, Hitchens, I don't know, in some of his judgments, I guess, particularly in regards to the Second Iraq War, you know, I have issues there. But yeah, you can sort of detect that, you know, he's socially liberal, he's cosmopolitan, he's interested in the world. And yet he helps, you know, unleash, you know, a terrible disaster in regards to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And as I was thinking about Wolfowitz, I couldn't help but think about Walt Rostow and about, you know, similarly, you know, Rostow was, you know, he was in the left of the Democratic Party in certain respects, and, you know, he wanted to increase taxation. He believed that the Kennedy administration could be more ambitious in regards to its goals vis-a-vis redistribution in regards to civil rights and so many sort of different areas. And yet there was this kind of strident belief that U.S. Intervention could transform all for the better many parts of the world, you know, not just Southeast Asia, not just Vietnam in the context of that war, but many different areas indeed. So Wolfowitz, you know, he does his PhD, is done at Yale. He serves in the Carter administration. This is his, you know, his first kind of substantive role within a presidential administration. He helps in many ways craft, you know, a set of ideas for what would become the Carter Doctrine, you know, in regards to the centrality of, you know, the Persian Gulf region to U.S. foreign policy concerns. So from a really early stage, you know, the late 70s, he's writing and thinking about Saddam Hussein which of course, you know, makes a huge difference when it comes to both the first and the second Iraq wars that happened further down the line. Now, he's advised by people, you know, he was taught by Alan Bloom, who has a huge influence on Wolf Woods, and by Leo Strauss, whose influence isn't quite as significant as some have suggested, but significant nonetheless. But he serves in the Carter administration, partly because, you know, he's at one with Carter on the importance of human rights, you know, in foreign policy. He's at one with Brzezinski in many ways and his, you know, fierce opposition to Soviet adventurism. He finds himself, you know, at home in many respects in that administration. But when it becomes apparent, you know, in 1979, that things are going, you know, from bad to worse for Carter, and that Reagan is the rising force in U.S. politics, he, you know, gets out of that administration, and with a view to hopefully getting a job in a Reagan administration, which, you know, Reagan and Carter, you know, share a lot of similarities, you know, in regards to their sort of foreign policy outlook, in regards to the, you know, this fiercely moralistic and fiercely anti-communist, you know, set of policies that Carter begins and that Reagan sort of continues in many different ways. So Wolfowitz feels, you know, very much at home in Reagan administration. There's some doubts among Reagan people that Wolfowitz is actually a genuine Republican, a conservative, and these doubts kind of stay with him through the 1980s. But, you know, he moves from various jobs in the administration. He serves as chair of policy planning briefly, the job that George Kennan, Paul Nitzer, Walt Rostow all had. And then, you know, later, of course, he serves in the first Bush administration, is, you know, very important as one of the architects, though not necessarily the principal author, of the Defense Policy Guidance Document of 1992, which is a very bold statement of what U.S. Post-Cold War foreign policy should do and what it should seek to achieve, and that is, you know, to forestall the advance of any sort of peer competitor in that realm. It's a very kind of aggressive, expansive document. But then, you know, through the Clinton era, up into his service in the Bush administration, he focuses ever more on Iraq and on the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. And to his neighbors and to his people, but also by, you know, he's intrigued by the potential that Iraq, because of, you know, the levels of education in that country, because of its sort of latent economic potential, this is a nation that the United States can potentially democratize and transform in the way that it democratized and transformed post-war Japan and post-war West Germany, a historical analogy that he deploys. You know, obviously this is really sort of problematic in many, many ways that, you know, I detail in the book, and many others have done so beside. But Wolfowitz serves in so many presidencies, has, you know, a diverse kind of set of interests, but he represents something that's very much in the ascendancy in the late 70s, the 80s. I mean, George H.W. Bush is disappointing in many respects. Clinton, in some ways, holds a certain degree of promise, but, you know, this fizzles out in many ways. He's not as strident in his pursuit of values as Wolfowitz would like. But then with Bush, George W. Bush, you know, there's a lunch, you know, he tells Wolfowitz, I think it's Wolfowitz, that, you know, he hasn't thought deeply about foreign relations, and he's very open to new ideas. And this, of course, is, wow, what an opportunity, you know, for Wolfowitz and others. You know, you have a blank slate waiting to be drawn on, at least according to the anecdote that's in Jacob Halbrand's book. They knew they were right, and, you know, he grasps it. And so, yeah, he's you know, interesting in so many different ways. And I think the parallel with Walt Rostow actually kind of works. It suits them. Suits mm-hmm. them both.
Yeah, I reading the Wolfowitz chapter, I was really thinking about just like how Wolfowitz's life is just such a good example of why biography really matters in U.S. foreign policy history, just because you can trace out a lot of these continuities between, you know, different regimes, but then also, you know, just as you can like get into like the contradictions of the ideas that are sometimes embodied in people.
Yeah.
So I thought that he was a really suitable candidate for your book.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just want to ask you one more question about the book. So the year is 2019. Your book came out half a decade ago, and it kind of concludes on some notes and questions about Barack Obama. Barack Obama is no longer the president of the United States. If you were to add another chapter to your book, you know, in that would sum up or represent the Trumpian foreign policy, is there a particular person or a set of ideas that would belong in that chapter?
So this is a really fascinating question, and in different sort of ways it's been put to me whenever I've kind of given a talk on the book, particularly obviously after Trump's election. And I've failed to answer it every time, in every instance that it's been put to me. And I'm sure I'm going to fail to answer it again here. And I just want to, a point on the book and how it ends. Initially, the idea with the book would be, was going to be, I'm going to write an epilogue, and the epilogue will discuss the Obama administration, but won't really go into great detail on Obama's foreign policies. And my editor was very keen that a full chapter should be researched and drafted on Obama. And I was so reluctant to do this because, researching and writing on a presidency in progress was just a horrific prospect to me. And maybe that discomfort is evident on a page. I'm not sure, but it certainly, I found that really, really tough. Now, my blind spots are so many, and my failings are so many, and they came out again in a talk I did at Council on Foreign Relations in the summer of 2016, so just before the presidential election, and it was on the legacy of the Obama administration, and my co-panelists were Daniel Dresner and Michael Mandelbaum, and we were all focusing on what are the major legacy issues for the Obama administration. And, we talked a bit about the Iran deal, the Paris climate deal, the Accords. We spoke a little bit about rapprochement in Cuba. We spoke a bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We spoke about so many issues and areas that the Trump administration has, purposely and very consciously set out to trash or dismantle. When I think about Obama's legacy now, and I think of the sort of the signature achievements in foreign policy, where do they lie? What is the substantive legacy? In some ways, I think it's Obama similar to Dwight Eisenhower, in that it's the paths that he didn't take that might prove to be more significant than the paths that he did. And the non-intervention or the decision not to intervene in Syria, for which, of course, Obama took immense flak, might turn out to be a significant legacy issue in the same way as Eisenhower's reluctance to intervene at Dien Bien Phu following French defeat, or to shore up the French position there, is a decision that he made, and it's one of his major legacy issues in certain ways. Now, thinking about Trump, essentially his message to the U.S., to the U.S. electorate, is that the individuals that I discuss in the book, particularly in the post-war period, have by and large done a fairly horrible job, in so many sort of different areas. The particular focus that Trump has, this notion that the United States is being ripped off, that the alliance system ushered in, the creation of NATO, something that one of Truman's kind of signature achievements. Well, actually, this is, it's becoming a ruse through which Europeans gain free security at the expense of U.S. taxpayers. His invocation of America First, echoing, the the title of the America First Committee, chaired by Charles Lindbergh, the appeals to a sort of a narrow nationalism, the racism, the distinct lack of interest in development aid. Many of the the policy areas that the individuals, or many of the individuals anyway, I believed in or held true, those are the values that Trump is directly challenging. And I think in terms of an individual, or in terms of a set of ideas that kind of animates Trump, it's hard. I mean, Steve Bannon probably is much more significant a figure in shaping Trump's worldview, say, than H.R. McMaster, who H.R. McMaster is like, a classic foreign policy intellectual, would absolutely fit into a book such as Worldmaking, given his PhD, given his background, his keen interest in foreign policy. Actually, McMaster blurbed my first book,
really?
the biography of Walt Rostow, which is I think it's probably my proudest achievement, is the fact that both H.R. McMaster and John Gray, the philosopher based uh-huh. the LSE, both blurbed that first book. And I think, a book that can appeal to such diverse thinkers as McMaster and Gray is, it may not be kind of worthy in and of itself, but certainly worth a look. Trump is, I'm very sympathetic to those who argue there's elements of continuity. Trump, when he launched the airstrikes against Assad, this kind of wave of adulation from individuals who had been decrying Trump, the never Trumpers, the sort of the Democrats who are obviously keenly supportive of a more interventionist type of foreign policy. For them, that was Trump being presidential, firing Tomahawk missiles, in the most futile way, at Syria and at this airfield. That was Trump, growing into the job. But these kind of these are few and far between. And Trump's, the comfort that he has clearly, or the greater comfort that he has in speaking with or in corresponding with Vladimir Putin, with so many other kind of authoritarian leaders across the world is kind of fascinating, but particularly his opposition to alliances. I mean, for a president to so botch relations with the UK, I mean, it's just the easiest relationship in the world. All you have to do is say, yeah, there's a special relationship every few months and everything's fine. Trump, his weighing in on Brexit, his criticism of Theresa May and her handling of it, his preference for a hard Brexit, it's remarkable, and his opposition, of course, to TPP to NAFTA, again, sort of challenges very fundamentally sort of essential verities that are held by the foreign policy establishment. So Trump probably marks the eclipse, in certain ways, of the type of foreign policy thinker that I write about and world making. Which is why I always struggle with this question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was a pretty comprehensive and very good answer. I also wonder if I can recall the beginning of your book, you discuss how you struggled to find an intellectual to represent the America Firsters.
Mm, yeah.
And then you ended up using Charles Beard as sort of America Firster. And I wonder if, for some of the same reasons that it was hard to find a representative of that movement, an intellectual representative of that movement, you were also struggling to find an intellectual representative of someone like Trump and his politics, which I agree there are tons of continuities, but then in many other regards, there's a whole eclectic range of idiosyncrasies.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very insightful parallel. I hadn't actually considered that before in reference to Trump, but yeah, Beard, that era, who are the prominent sort of advocates of isolation, Charles Coughlin and Charles Lindbergh and other, chauvinistic, anti-Semitic kind of, this kind of this type of individual, you know, clearly was not one that I was keen to write about. But you know, in large part because there's no great substantive foreign policy vision, that sort of animates them. But in regards to Trump and America First, yeah, there is. Probably Steve Bannon. Actually, the more I think about it, and I know he's not in the administration anymore, but I think his influence has been profound in many ways.
Well, I think that's a wonderful place to leave the book. And I just want to ask you a quick question. Maybe you can say a few words on it. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, so I'm writing a book about a journalist who worked for the Chicago Tribune. And she lived in Berlin from 1911 to 1941, and her name was Sigrid Schultz. So it's a book that examines the arc of her life and career because she lived in Berlin for this pivotal kind of 30-year period. She had an incredibly nuanced, deep understanding of German politics, of interwar Germany, of the rise and fall of the Weimar Republic, in which she reported. She very kind of consciously, near the end of the 1920s, early 30s, cultivated Hermann Göring because she anticipated that the Nazi Party was going to be a major force in German politics. And through Göring, she was able to interview Hitler, and through the 1930s, her reporting was hugely impressive in the most trying of circumstances. So, you know, the Gestapo attempted to frame her for espionage at one point. Unlike Dorothy Thompson, who was ejected from Germany because of her hostile reporting, Schultz was careful never to go too far in regards to insulting Hitler and the higher echelons of the Nazi Party. But then she also had to navigate publishing in a newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, whose editor, his proprietor, was an isolationist, William McCormick. So it was an incredibly difficult job that she had through this period, but she performed it with aplomb. She got a scoop on the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. She broke that story. She was injured in a bombing raid, a British bombing raid on Berlin in late 1940, and then returned to Germany in 1944. Where she became one of the first journalists to enter the Buchenwald camp and report from there. And then she later covered the beginning of the Nuremberg trials. So, from interviewing General Ludendorff in 1919 to Hitler in 1931 and to meeting many prominent Nazis after they had been apprehended and were about to go on trial at Nuremberg, it's a really fascinating, well-informed and at times brilliant sort of perspective on this period. And also, the challenges that she confronted as a woman and in a male-dominated profession and society are kind of fascinating to behold as well. So it's another biography, but it's one that doesn't focus on U.S. foreign policy per se, but certainly focuses on a particular American in the world.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a fascinating project.
Yeah, thank you.
David, I want to thank you again for speaking with me today. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Perfect. And thank you for listening to the New Books in Intellectual History podcast.